Thank you, Dr. Evans. And so you know already that we have played a little fast and loose with the schedule of presentations in this session. So on the schedule, there are two separate presentations that both talk about the evaluation of the Mental Health First Aid Initiative in Philadelphia. We have combined those into one presentation, and I will give that presentation in tandem with my colleagues, Amy Carroll Scott and Shoshana Aikens. And we have no relationships to disclose. So a quick history lesson. Mental Health First Aid is an evidence-based program. It was developed in Australia in 2001. You can see the mascot is a little koala bear to reflect that. And has been practiced in the US since 2007. There are currently mental health first aid instructors in 45 states around the country. And nationally, the program is coordinated by the National Council for Behavioral Health. So there are three goals of mental health first aid: to enhance mental health awareness and literacy, increase early intervention and access to behavioral health treatment, and also to reduce behavioral health stigma through community training and resilience. Now, in order to accomplish this, and the clicking is not, oh, there we go. Mental health first aid training itself is an 8-hour training taught by certified instructors that can be completed in 1 8-hour block or 2 4-hour blocks. And what this training does is provide a toolkit for people to help other people around them who are developing a mental illness or experiencing a mental health crisis. And this toolkit centers around a very concrete 5-step action plan with the mnemonic ALG, which stands for assessing for risk of suicide or harm, listening non-judgmentally, giving reassurance and information, encouraging appropriate professional help, and encouraging self-help and other support strategies. So there's a really broad-based initiative of mental health first aid training in the city of Philadelphia throughout the entire city, led by Dr. Evans in the Department of Behavioral Health. And this training is available in community through two different venues. It's broadly available through free community-based trainings. There are a number of community hubs where this training is provided throughout the city, and any community member can sign up and attend the free training. I've done it myself. You can sign up through the Healthy Minds Philly website that Dr. Evans showed you earlier. And then trainings are also available through employers. So for example, police and fire departments in Philadelphia are training staff, as well as the School District of Philadelphia and other private and public employers around the city. And there are targeted versions of the training that are targeted to people who interact with or work with specific populations. So there's an adult and a youth version, one targeted to public safety, one targeted to veterans, and there's one for higher education that is on its way soon. And in total, over 10,000, and actually I think at this point it's over 11,000 Philadelphians have been trained in mental health first aid. And this map gives you an idea, just to show you that these are zip codes of where there are first aiders. We call trained people who've had the training first aiders, where they are around the city. And you'll notice that there are aiders citywide, but there is variation by area. And so one of the things we're looking at in this evaluation is, do we see any differences in communities based on how many aiders we have in these different communities around the city? So this year, one of our first tasks was really just to characterize who are Philadelphia first aiders. Who are these aiders we have trained through various venues who are out in our communities? And we used a few different data sources to do this. We integrated them together, and each data source gave us a slightly different snapshot of the aiders in Philly. So first of all, we used information from the Philadelphia MHFA office itself. This includes information from sign-in sheets at the trainings that people fill out, as well as other records. We also used information from the National Council of Behavioral Health. That's the organization I mentioned that coordinates MHSA nationwide. And the idea there is that when each aider finishes his or her 8-hour training, there's an evaluation form to fill out. And then the instructors take the data from those evaluation forms and input them into a system that goes back to the National Council. And the National Council was able to bounce back to us the aggregated data for trainings that occurred in Philadelphia. We also administered some online surveys 3 and 6 months post-training to aiders in Philadelphia. And my colleague Shoshana is going to give you more information later on in the presentation about the methods and the results around those surveys. So we're also pulling data from those surveys. And then finally, from the census. This is a community-wide initiative, so we wanted to just get some idea of what our aider population looks like relative to the population in Philadelphia. So the next few slides are pretty similar. I'm just showing you some different distributions of what the aiders, the first aiders in Philadelphia look like. So I'll walk you through this slide, and then the next few slides are similar. So in the dark blue on the left, we have the city of Philadelphia. The medium blue in the middle, that's information that came from those evaluation forms I mentioned that aiders fill out at the end of training. And then in the light blue, we have information from people who completed our online survey. And the reason I have the evaluation form and the survey data separately is just to show you that, as you can imagine, we invite every trained aider to complete the survey, but not all do. And in some ways, it's a select group of people who complete the surveys, people who have the time, who have the computer access to do so. So just to show you, it's a little bit of a distinct group. But in general, we have aiders of all age, adult age groups throughout the city, although aiders are more likely to be of working age than the city as a whole. Aiders are also more likely to be female. Are more likely to self-identify as Black or African American than the city as a whole, and less likely to identify as Hispanic or Latino and Asian or Asian American. And then finally, there's some pretty large education differences between the aider population and the city of Philly as a whole, although again, there's representation across the different education groups. This is not that surprising when you keep in mind that we know that about half of our first aiders in Philadelphia first found out about or attended the training through work. So while this is a community-based, a community-wide program, we are getting a lot of professionals who are taking the training. This is just to give you a quick idea. These are the fields of work that people who took our online survey reported. So you can see on the left here, we do have a large number of people who are professionals in behavioral health or in other social services that are may not be as directly behavioral health related. And I'm going to pass the baton now to Shoshana.
Thank you so much, Felice. So I was on the Mental Health First Aid research group for this, and we did 2 different online surveys, as we talked about earlier. There was one that was sent out at 3 months, and there was one that was sent out at 6 months. We not only split this up just because nobody wants to take a huge survey, but also because we were looking at 2 different things. The 3-month was looking at knowledge and use of what they learned in their training, and the 6 month looked at attitudes and stuff like stigma and kind of how they feel about their training. So we did this from February 2014 until May 2015. It was a bunch of different kind of questions. There was multiple choice write-in questions, rating questions, and this was sent out to about 300 to 600 first aiders. As we kind of touched on earlier, because this is an online survey, it was. There's a lot of different setbacks to that. Did somebody have the email? Did we get the right email? Did we get it over to them? So that's why we were only able to reach 300 to 600 every month. But we had pretty high response ratios for each. We had 15% for the 3 months, 11% for the 6 months, and 170 people took both the 3 and 6. So we were able to compare that data, which was really great. So this is one of the questions for the number of times that they used algae. We see that the large number was 1 to 5, but what was really interesting is that there's a skip where the next highest is people who are using it 10 or more. And as we kind of touched on earlier, it's because there's a lot of people who work in the mental health field who ended up taking the survey. So this data kind of backed that up, which was really great. So this is the different algae steps. They're all written out, but it's written A-L-G-E-E. So something really interesting that we found from this is that everybody seemed to use all of them, which is really, really great, but that the listening and the given reassurance were the most used ones, and those are the least clinical ones. The more things like referencing people to help, those were used a whole lot less. So, and then of course, as we were talking about earlier, this is just a theme thing. Most people are help their clients or patients, and that's because again, there's a lot of people who took the survey who are mental health, who work in the mental health field. So these are the referrals to professional help. So a lot of it was spread out all over, but there is still a lot of people who are not making any. And that was kind of the theme that we saw through a whole lot of these questions. The same thing, there's a lot of people who didn't make any. And the next highest was the self-help group. And these are the mental health resources. Again, the highest is that they didn't use any, which is very, very sad. But we also found that a lot of people referenced to the Mental Health First Aid website, which is really great because we tried to make that a very useful resource for everyone. And then again, not too many people use this one. And the most highest was the crisis mobile team. And then these are, this was actually a really great part of it. We had a lot of open text, and a shocking number of people actually spent the time to really talk about how they felt about the training, what were their thoughts on it. And so this was a really great quote that we had from the online survey. By taking the course for youth, it was able to open my eyes to all the things that a typical high school student may be fearing or dealing with. From an inner standpoint, it takes you back to what you could be feeling and put yourself in their shoes to better help them deal with substance, eating disorders, psychoses, as well as other mental health challenges that may ail our youth. And these are another two really great quotes. Mental health first aid increased my awareness of mental health issues and broadened my understanding of the causes and treatment of these issues. It increased tolerance and empathy toward these people experiencing these issues. And this one, which is very based on stigma, I am so less afraid to ask questions and to be with someone who is experiencing pain. We found that a lot of people were really impacted just by the stigma that of mental health, and this training really opened them up to understand that these are people, these are humans that need help, and that we can really reach out. I'm going to pass it to Amy. Encouraged, I can't think of them off the top of my head.
Encouraged support.
Encouraged support and encouraged, I think, mental health resources, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Professional support and then also self-help.
Professional support and self-help, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana. So I should mention that that Nancy Epstein, who's in my department at Drexel, who's had a long-standing relationship with the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services, led up the survey research and approached me because of work that I had been doing in community resilience, and said that she felt like we needed to move beyond the AIDR survey and to understand better, more of the ripple effects of this approach in the community. I think something I've heard Dr. Evans say, which really struck me, was that when someone's having a heart attack, folks run toward that person to help. And when someone is having a mental health issue or crisis, folks run away from the situation. And so how could we start to set up the Department of Behavioral Health and the Mental Health First Aid Program in Philadelphia to be able to do that over the long term, as it makes these multi-levels of impact. So we had a three-prong approach, or we have a three-prong approach, but we spent all last year starting out this three-prong approach by starting by providing technical assistance to the program to maximize all the data it was already collecting. As you know, collecting data on registrations, especially when registrations are being done by different training partners, it makes the data of varying quality and of varying completeness. And then also dealing with when folks, there's always different folks who sign up than the subset who come to the training. So taking a look at all of those data and monitoring systems, and to make sure that they're just firmed up to be so that we know that that data is as reliable and of good quality as we can. But we also want to think next up, how can we create a citywide behavioral health indicators surveillance system that could help us look across the city, the maps that you've seen, but then in particular neighborhoods and zip codes and various planning districts or school districts, how could we look at change over time and relate it to where ADERs are clustered? And so setting up a system for that, which I'll describe in a second. And then we want to be able to look more multi-level beyond the aider experience and to those that they're aiding. And so we wanted to work really hard looking from the literature and our colleagues around the country who are doing this research to be able to develop methods and measures and then to seek funding to do an impact study of mental health first aid so that we could really take a look at those ripple effects. So just a quick mention of our TA plan. We did a lot of work, and there's a new registration system, and we've put new fields into that to be able to get more information. In particular, we wanted to understand where folks are working, which is what the registration had prior collected, but also where they're living, and so that we can get a sense for those who are using it at home and at work. They might have a professional behavioral health position, but that doesn't mean that they're turning off these skills when they go home to their families and their communities and their churches. And so we want to collect better locational data so that we have an even better sense of where ADERs are clustered. And also, if they're working at a central location office, but their work takes them to North Philadelphia or to West Philadelphia or Southwest Philadelphia, you want to know where they're applying those. So we don't just have these large clusters around these administrative office addresses, but where folks are going out into the field and using them. And so we wanted to make sure to, of course, improve the monitoring data and systems that we talked about. Also encourage some evaluative language in the memorandums of understanding with training partners to make sure that there's minimum registration and other data that's collected just to help our monitoring citywide. To move the ADER online survey in-house. We found through the ADER survey it was extremely helpful. It was a necessary first step. It should continue, but it can now be mechanized within the infrastructure of signing folks up and sending out reminders and sending thank yous for taking the survey and having folks take that survey on an ongoing basis. So we're in the process of moving that survey in-house. We also, through our contacts or other evaluators, are doing this work, in particular with Georgetown and the National Council for Behavioral Health. Our ADER survey data look a lot like other ADER survey data. So trying to mechanize that so that we can now move beyond that and focus more of our attention on the impact. And then to provide trainings or technical assistance capacity building as needed to support all of these new or improved processes. So then we spent a lot of time talking about community health indicators, created a laundry list of all the potential indicators we could take a look at. But we wanted to make sure that it fit several criteria. One is that it could we could potentially theorize or hypothesize that it could change as a result of increasing ADERs in the community, the increasing of the diffusion of innovation of this type of model and skills throughout Philadelphia. So we wanted to make sure that there are indicators that we felt could change as a result of that kind of training and skill. We wanted also to make sure that it provided information about behavioral health in the city as a whole, but also allow us to do these comparisons throughout different cities of Philadelphia. If we're always just looking at citywide data in aggregate, it's not going to tell us us much of a story of these smaller neighborhood stories that we want to be able to tell. And more importantly, that it's feasible to collect on an ongoing basis, that we could gain access to the data and that we could do it on an annual basis so we can take a look over time. So we took a look at 34 indicators. We spoke a lot with all of the members of the team. We've narrowed it down to 22. And the ones that we chose fit different types of data. There's survey data. There's behavioral health care service provision and utilization data. In particular, we have wonderful data available from the very fact that the Department of Behavioral Health is the Medicaid managed care mental health service provision agency in the city, so that certainly gives us access to a lot of wonderful data. We also are looking at MHFA training and use by key populations, so just our monitoring data, school indicators, and workplace indicators. And so this is literally hot off the, not even press, it's hot off the statistical software analysis package. In fact, Dr. Evans hasn't even seen this yet, but just to give you a sense of what we've gathered for this year and the kinds of things we'd like to be able to do. This comes from the YRBS, and again, this is just a citywide snapshot, but taking a look at an indicator of youth suicide attempts in the past 12 months. So these are youth, you know, the YRBS is administered through schools, and so these are kids in high school grades 9 through 12, and these are attempted suicides in the past 12 months in the city of Philadelphia. And the data allows us to take a look by gender and by race ethnicity. And so again, this is something that we'll be able to look at over time. Just another snapshot, hot off the press, is again from the Community Behavioral Health, which is the service provision agency. We have just here the number of adults using any behavioral health service last year, and in this case, we're looking at it by zip code. So taking a look at where you see the darker colors, where, and I'm sorry, Dr. Evans, you call that penetration, I think, right? Mm-hmm. So looking at penetration of these services citywide and to see, does that change over time? So then just to take you to the third prong of our approach is, you know, now digging deep. This is giving us a system citywide that we hope to be able to look at changes over time, relate that to where, to our monitoring data, and looking to see where ADERs are clustered. But now we're spending a lot of our attention thinking about how we can dig deep and look at those multi-level of effects. So of course we started by all the wonderful work that's come before us, and taking a look at evaluations, which really have focused a lot thus far on monitoring and on ADER experience and ADER reports of the use of their training. But as is typical, actually in many other fields in public health, which you guys know, there's lack of evaluation of the end user effect. I mean, it is just difficult in any train-the-trainer program, a lot of my work has been in community health outreach workers or, you know, lay health workers and, you know, sort of getting to those that they help, particularly when that person may or may not know that the person, likely do not know that the person who helped them was trained in this. It's methodologically very difficult, and so there isn't a lot in the field. And so what we wanted to do was piggyback on the fact that the Youth Mental Health First Aid received a very large amount of funding from Obama in response to the Newtown shootings and other school violence. And so there was a lot of money put into Project AWARE, which you may be aware of. but the problem with those funds is that they're mostly for training, which is wonderful, but there's minimal evaluation support built into those grants. And so we felt like there was a need here to better understand multi-level impacts more locally. I mean, it's great to look at Project AWARE grantees nationally. I think there's 170 of them now, maybe another one that's under review right now, another cohort. But unless we really dig down locally, I think we're going to miss an opportunity to be able to understand the methods and measures needed to do this in any context, in a school or in a community, and to be able to you know, bring that feedback up to these, you know, systems level, both service provision, program provision, and also evaluation. And so we decided to do a study in the School District of Philadelphia. Not just because of Project AWARE, but also because it's a bit more of a contained community in which we can collect data and try to understand these ripple effects, you know, and learn from that before we then try to take it neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community. So there was a funding from the Van Amerigen Foundation to the School District of Philadelphia to do a cohort of youth mental health first aid training in the schools. The school district, which is makes national news, unfortunately, it's very underfunded. It's having a lot of concerns with resources, and in particular, behavioral health workers and other folks in the schools. While there is a lot of behavioral health needs and crises happening in the schools, this funding was to be able to bring the training to 8 schools and to be able to provide incentives for the teachers and to the administrators of the schools to be able to support the training in the midst of all the other, you know, teacher training and other initiatives that they have. So what we're doing this year in our first year of the study is that we're collecting some primary data. We're kind of we have approval from the school district. We're not going in and collecting a ton of primary data right away in respect to their systems and processes. But what we are doing is going to be understanding training implementation, all the participation rates by school. There's varying levels of support for this from the different administrators. So we will be doing, of course, interviews with all the principals, all of the behavioral health workers that work part-time or full-time in these schools, and a subset of the teachers and other staff. And then in the highest and lowest adopting schools of those 8, based on the monitoring data and those interviews, we'll do a series of focus groups at the end of the school year with students to talk to them about the experience of their school climate. I'll talk about what we'll ask in a second. And then we're also looking at secondary data. So between spring 2015, so this past spring, there's district-wide school climate surveys or district-wide school surveys that have school climate questions in them that we'll be taking a look at. And we'll be looking at a variety of other secondary data, including attendance suspensions, crisis line calls, mental health crises in the school, and YRBS survey data. So at the school level, we're going to be, as I mentioned, looking at adoption of the program, principal support, and of course numbers of those trained, whether or not the school is inspired by this training and does any booster sessions or any community dialogues or anything to support the work beyond just the training. So anything like that happens, or any other behavioral health changes that are made, we will capture that in the monitoring and the interviews. And then, of course, as I mentioned, we'll be looking at these school climate and behavioral health indicators at the school level. Among the school personnel, what the interviews will be doing, we'll be looking at perceptions of school climate, mental health stigma, of course, self-efficacy to handle student behavioral health needs, use of the training since they received it, or use of the skills since they received the training, and awareness of behavioral health needs in the school and available resources for the students and for themselves as those who are caring for the students. In the student focus groups, we'll talk to them about perceptions of school climate, whether or not they've perceived any changes over the school year. We'll talk to them about mental health stigma and their self-reported experiences of their own, if appropriate, but also of, you know, just school-wide behavioral health issues and needs, their perceptions of behavioral health resources available to them. And then their perceptions of school staff and teachers as being supportive or not, and the strategies that have been successful around these needs in their school, as well as peer perceptions and norms and support around behavioral health. So I hope to come back next year and talk to you about what we found, but just wanted to give background on all of the work that went into trying to set ourselves up for looking at impact. So there are quite a lot of challenges to this that I want to share, because I think for those of you who are doing this kind of work, it's really important, of course, to share challenges just as much as successes, and you know, and share with you what our next steps are, but also where I feel the field needs to go, and you know, and I'm hopeful that we're all having these kinds of conversations. One is that these, when you're doing it, something at such a broad scale like Philadelphia is, it's really difficult to link up these data. I mean, just to give you a sense, these are the data that we presented in the beginning, and this is where they overlap. Right, so the MHFA program is doing the best job of monitoring because they want to know when they get to 10,000, 11,000. But even they have some struggles getting some of those data from their training partners. Then the National Council of Behavioral Health Evaluations, which are required of all instructors to report at the end of their training, but technically they only have to do it for 3 a year in order to keep their certification, so that's a bit spotty, and you see that there's, you know, an overlap, but it's not 100%. And then our online surveys, obviously, are only for those for whom we had a valid email address from the sign-in forms. As Shoshana mentioned earlier, I think really well, But just to say that, of course, we're only capturing a subset. And because they're the folks who are sitting in front of a computer with a valid email address and cares very much to take the survey, that's why we're capturing mostly just behavioral health workers in that. But we want to be able to get out and be able to talk to more folks who are taking this as a result of having someone in the family that they want to be able to care better for, being involved in their church group or their neighborhood civic association. We want to be able to understand those experiences. And so, that survey bubble needs to get bigger. These other data sources need to get bigger. Collecting quality aider location measures that I talked about earlier has been difficult because it means taking folks either through the registration or the sign-in process before they've even, had the training, trying to capture them before, folks who might, duck out as soon as the training is over, trying to get them to tell us, where do you live? Would you use this at home? Where do you work? Where does that work located, as I mentioned earlier? And so, so that's been a challenge, and it's something that we're working on, and I think, improving the systems are a big part of that. Understanding how the aiders are using outside of their work. So not just are they using it outside of the work, but how and in what ways is really important, and is really important for any kind of impact study. And then determining which behavioral health indicators are most likely to change or improve as a result of MHFA training. We can do our best guess, but until we start to see movement, it'll be tough to know, are we looking at the right kinds of indicators, or do we need to think about setting up new systems of data collection and new indicators of improvements in these areas. Finding and collecting experiences and outcomes from those helped by aiders. So we would ideally love to do some qualitative work where we, through some sort of social network type method or respondent-driven sampling to try to understand those who are impacted by an aider who came to their aid. And so that would involve some sort of multi-level of talking to the aiders and then talking to those that they have helped. And then also, one of our next steps is to make sure that we have funding to be able to conduct a more robust randomized control trial of MHFA impact in the schools. What this will look like is, having intervention schools, having delayed schools as service controls, and to be able to collect a little bit more primary data from both the teachers and administrators as we had, as we're doing this year, but also from parents and students. And be able to take a look at that, before and after training, ideally, even a year after training, and then to be able to look at, how that differs from the delayed school and make comparisons of impact. So that's where we are. That's where we're going next. I hope to talk to you next year about it. And we do want to acknowledge all those who helped us with this work. And I think Dr. Evans, if you want to take a field question. Yeah, so no, we're done now, so we're Q&A.
It's Q&A and discussion. Okay, so great. So great presentations. I'm very excited. So we'll get to some questions. Let me just do a little framing, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So I want you to not underestimate the importance of the work that our colleagues at Drexel are doing. As Dr. Carol Scott said, one of the challenges in the field is that we have very good process measures, right? So we know how many people were trained. We know how many people took the training. We know how many people did whatever the activities are. What we don't know is, are we getting the impact that we really thought we would get? And this is really the first that I know of systematic study of mental health first aid in the country. And if you think about where healthcare is going right now, which is really starting to think about population health strategies. And the reason that we're moving to population health strategies is we figured out the way our focus on only treating people who are ill is going to bankrupt us, basically. And so we figured that we're going to have to put much more emphasis on early intervention, on prevention, on treating the non-diagnosed part of the population. As we start to do that, we've given you some sense of at least how we're starting to think about that from a behavioral health standpoint. And then the issue comes up for us very quickly, well, it's great that we're doing murals. It's great that we're doing mental health first aid. It's great that we're doing all of these strategies. We intuitively think that they make sense. We have great anecdotal data, but the measurement issue for us is how do you really know at a population level that these things are happening? So that's the significance of this in my view, and the fact that we have such a well thought out strategy to look at those issues on this one particular set of interventions, I think is really important. So with that, we're gonna open it up and see what questions you have, comments you have, reactions you have. And we have about 25 minutes. Yes. That's a great question. So the question is, how much interest did we get initially? And I would say that we've gotten a lot of interest for mental health first aid across the board. And I often, when I talk about mental health first aid, it's probably, for me, it's probably the most accepted intervention that we've done from a public health standpoint. When we talk to, and it really doesn't matter, we're talking to people in the faith community. We have a whole strategy with the faith community. We're talking with people in the human services and healthcare. We even train medical students, which I thought, you know, this is a 1 hour, this is a 1 day course, and most medical students don't get the amount of mental health training that folks are getting within mental health aid. And so when we've done this even with medical students, they loved it because they said, we don't really get, you know, this. And so across the board, we're, you know, whether it's the business community, all of the firefighter, well, not all the firefighter, all of the police who are trained in Philadelphia, who go through the academy, now get this course, firefighters, force responders, all of our criminal justice partners have bought into this. So the courts, the district attorney, the public defender, are all training people because they recognize there's so many people that come through the criminal justice system who have behavioral health conditions. They're lawyers. They don't know what they're looking at. They don't know how to deal with that. And so they recognize we really need this. The National Constitution Center, which is one of our tourist areas, we have businesses. Even Comcast has trained some of their workers. And so we've gotten a really good response to this, and it's been, as I said, one of the most important things I've seen in terms of reducing and changing, reducing stigma and changing people's perception. Yes?
Well, I have a few questions, but first what I want to ask you is, when people respond to wanting to have training, do they have to do it based on an organizational group, or can they do it individually?
They can do it as an individual. So the question is, how effective can it be if I, as an individual, take the training and I'm not my whole workplace? Well, to me, it's the same as if you were to take CPR, right? So if you take CPR, even if no one else in your environment took CPR, you can be very effective in intervening and helping an individual who's in crisis. And so it's the same way that we look at mental health first aid in the same way. Our goal is to get to as many people in Philadelphia who are trained in CPR to also have mental health first aid training, because we want to saturate it. This, for us, this is a mental health literacy strategy as well. And so even though other people in your context may not have gotten the training, we still think that you as an individual can be impactful. And I'll say one other thing about that. You reminded me, one of the partnerships we have in Philadelphia is with the American Red Cross. And so typically when we talk about mental health first aid, we liken it to CPR. And the folks at the Philadelphia Red Cross got it. And now in Philadelphia, we actually offer mental health first aid in conjunction with CPR. So I call it first aid for the head and the heart at the same time. So you can do it one time, get it done. Yes. So the question was the sense of whether the extent to which people can access mental health services, is it getting better or not because of the ACA? I think it depends a lot on each community that you're in. In Philadelphia, for example, I recently did congressional testimony, and the hearing was on access to psychiatric beds. And the premise of the congressional hearing was that people who are in psychiatric crisis can access beds. Well, that's true in a lot of places, but it's not true in all places. And in fact, in Philadelphia, we are probably overbedded for adult psychiatric beds. And so you have to ask that question about access by community, and you have to ask the question in terms of access to what? So access to adult psychiatric beds in Philadelphia is not an issue. But if you talk about adult or children's psychiatric beds, it is an issue. If you talk about community mental health services, not so much of an issue. And so you have to look more at a profile than sort of a generic statement. I think that the ACA is actually going to reveal a challenge that we have in the behavioral health field. And that is, we have a huge workforce issue. If nothing had changed, we were going to be taxed, because if you look at the average age of people in the behavioral health field, it's 50s and 60s. There are a lot of people that are going to be leaving the field over the next decade, and there are not a lot of people coming into the field. And so I think the issue we have to think about in terms of access is both how do we get more people in, but also how do we start to develop other strategies that don't require a psychiatrist or a psychologist or people that are trained at that level. So another, yes. Yeah, we actually, crisis intervention teams, you're talking about for police? Yes, so crisis intervention teams are when you train police officers to recognize signs and symptoms of people who are in psychiatric distress, and it trains the officers to actually respond differently in those situations. In my view, in the absence of that training, police officers respond the same way to everyone, and for people who are in psychiatric crisis, that is always bad. It's bad for the officers, it's bad for individuals. So about 7 years ago, we started crisis intervention training in Philadelphia. We've trained about almost 50% of the Philadelphia police force across the city, and I think it's made a huge difference. When I took the job, we unfortunately had fairly regularly incidents where police and a person who was in psychiatric distress, where the person actually got shot or hurt and sometimes killed in those situations. And we just don't have those kinds of situations anymore, primarily, we think, because the officers that are dispatched when there are those kinds of situations is someone who's trained. Yeah. Sure. That's a great question, and that's why I love these folks, because, you know, even though, this is a perfect question that you're asking, which is, I know intuitively, and I've talked to the police commissioner, we know that the incidence of people being hurt or injured in those situations is going way down, because we don't get the calls, we're not involved in that. What we really need to do is to take that a step further and look at what does the data really say? I will say there was a glimpse of hope there in terms of the data. We work very closely with the University of Pennsylvania as well. One of the things that we think is happening is that fewer people who are mentally ill are actually getting into our criminal justice system at the front door. We need to verify that and confirm that, but we have some early data that suggests that there are fewer people who are actually mm-hmm. going in, and we think that might be because officers are recognizing when, you know, this is someone who really needs to be in a mental health system. Yes. Interesting question. So the question is, do we think that this might make people more sensitive or overly sensitive to people having mental health challenges? We've seen no evidence of that. And in fact, what I think happens is that most people are, if you don't work in the field, most people are afraid of people who have a mental health condition. They're afraid if they think that they have a family member or a friend who is suicidal, they are afraid to ask the question because they're afraid it might put the thought in their head. Right? Or if they get an answer, they're not sure what they're going to do. So I think what mental health first aid does is it helps people to break that barrier. People are more likely to know how to support someone. We have an example of a woman who took mental health first aid training, and then the very next week her daughter was suicidal and she knew what to do. Or in some instances, a woman who took mental health first aid, she had an adult son who had schizophrenia. And typically what would happen is if he started to become ill, he could get violent, she would run upstairs, lock the door, and call the police. Bad, you know, bad potential situation in those things. Now, fortunately, CIT officers are responding, and those situations don't escalate. But after the mental health first aid training, rather than locking herself in the room, she sat with her son and waited for help to come. So I think that rather than making people overly sensitive, I think what it does is it makes people feel more comfortable with the kinds of issues that come up for people who are experiencing mental health issues.
So data show that a lot of the treatment is going to people that are already on the field, and mm-hmm. These are people that are practicing and training already. So have some of the reasons why it's not given to the people that, you know, regular people that may use this anymore, it's because you're having an 8-hour training. And perhaps some of these people are in jobs that do not let you take, you know,
sure. Good. Yeah. Great. Another great question. So, what are we doing to expand? So, the first thing I would say is, and we should look at this. I suspect that even though there are a lot of people who say they're in the behavioral health field who are taking the training, they're not behavioral health professionals. Some of them probably are, but you have people who are secretaries or people who are at the front desk, and this training can be very helpful to individuals who are non-clinicians who are working in behavioral health settings and are sort of not always sure how to interact with people. So I suspect that one of the reasons that we see those numbers are these are non-clinicians, because if you're a clinician, you probably don't think you need to take the training. Secondly, you know, our strategy, and you know, what we're doing in Philadelphia is a little different than the way lots of communities have done it. First of all, we're a government entity that has sort of taken the lead on this. We've partnered with lots of different organizations, and we have sort of a 2-3-pronged strategy. So one is, you know, we make the training available to any individual. So if you go to that website, healthymindsphilly.org, you can sign up. There are all of the courses are there. You can do that as an individual. The second strategy we have is to partner and very, very intentionally try to get this training into certain systems and organizations. So within Philadelphia, almost all of the human service organizations, many of the healthcare organizations, all of the criminal justice organizations, as I mentioned to you, educational, those are systems that we systematically targeted, and either we went in and we trained people within those systems to become trainers who then trained their colleagues. That's what we did with the criminal justice. So the criminal justice folks, people in the DA's office, in the court's office, they train people and then they train their colleagues. And then sort of the third strategy is sometimes organizations don't want to take on the training itself. We'll still work with them in terms of doing that. The other strategy that we have is creating community hubs. So we have certain faith organizations, for example, that have become, actually my church has become a hub. It's a large mega church, 15,000 members. But what they will do is they will be a host, inviting people in their geographic area to come in and take the training. The National Constitution Center, as I mentioned, is a host. And so people will come in and take the training there. So it's another strategy. So, you know, our goal, if we really want to integrate this into the entire community, we think we have to work in multiple kinds of ways and partner with people in different sort of different configurations.
You know, if I could say one more thing to that too.
Yeah, I think you need to. Yeah, the recording.
Keep in mind too that it's just our survey that's picking up that the majority of them are reporting that they're in the behavioral health field in some way. So that's six. What was the total, Shoshana? 744, something like that, out of the over 11,000 trained. So where we're having more difficulty is not necessarily in reaching the community folks, but in systematically collecting information from them about their experience. That's where we're having a bit of those evaluation challenges and trying to supplement it with these other ways.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes.
So the National Council of Behavioral Health has a post-evaluation training, which is basically just immediate post-training satisfaction and some changes in mental health stigma and you know, and sort of awareness of and skills. So that's two pages, I think, one front and back. And that is, like I said, not every single one is sent to National Council. They were kind enough to, Mary Wachansky, who is up here, was kind enough to cut those data for me, but it's not something that they do systematically. So we were lucky to get that data and take a look at it again. No, what we are talking about is the 3 and 6 month post-training online survey that we send out invitations to everyone who had been trained 3 and 6 months prior that we had email addresses for. As you can imagine, for anybody who does community work, a lot of those emails bounce back, and so that's part of the challenge.
Yes.
Yes, I wondered if you could go back to that, perhaps the benefit of the community that might want to emulate what Philadelphia has done, and tell us, from the get-go, how you marketed this to the community so that it became something all of a sudden you have these trainings and people gravitating toward. What was the whole marketing plan?
Yeah, so what's the marketing plan that we used? So I think, one of the things we've tried to do is to normalize mental health in within the city. And we've tried to do that. And the reason I took the time to sort of give you the broader context for this work is to just indicate that we're talking to the community in lots of different ways about mental health issues, and we're coming at it from different angles. I think as we've done that, it's rare that I talk to a community group and don't mention mental health first aid. So part of it is when we started, if I go back to the very beginning, we started with a grant specifically targeting the, we had a few grant dollars and we wanted to figure out how we could best use those grant dollars. This was working with the criminal justice system. And so we started with the criminal justice system. But once we sort of opened the door, we got people trained in Philadelphia, it became clear to us that this was a great opportunity to take this concept and apply it across the entire population. And so initially we tried to do, I guess sort of more of a generic marketing, advertise the training and hope that people would sign up for it. Didn't work quite as well. And so what we did then is we actually built infrastructure. What I didn't say, this is actually very important for communities that are interested in doing this. I took money out of my budget. I talked about, you know, out of the budget that I have, less than 2%, and 1-2% is used for anything other than treating illness, right? So what we did is we took savings that we had from our management of the system, created a specific unit. We have full-time people who their job is to manage this process. The other thing is sort of to your point, we made the training free. In many communities, you have to actually pay for this. And so the way we made it free was that we will train instructors. That cost comes out of my budget. We will train the instructors. There are materials that go along with the training. We pay for all of those materials. We get people to donate sites. Sometimes we have to pay for sites, but usually one of the reasons that we have these community partners is so that we will have access to sites that we don't have to pay for. And so all the costs associated with the training now are borne by my agency. We're starting to look at the private sector and businesses. I mentioned Comcast. There are other entities that are starting to look at the training. When we move to the private sector, we may have a different model. But so far, it's been not that. It's been more of a model of making this completely free to the public. The having full-time staff, and we have about 5 or 6 people, including support staff, actually 7 or 8 people, including support staff, who do this. Some people are assigned to working with the faith community. Others are assigned, you know, another person assigned with the criminal justice. And so these are folks that will go out, they'll do a presentation. They'll explain what it is, they'll explain what the commitment is. And it's really through that kind of systematic marketing directly to communities that we're trying to get to that we've been able to get folks. But the other thing is, as people hear this, people are saying, like, this is something that my workplace needs, or this is something that, you know, my church needs, or my synagogue, or my masjid. And so part of it is, you know, sort of a global, but some of it is very targeted. Well, the media has been, I think, very good. So covering a lot of the public health stuff that we've done. So the mental health screening, so when we did the kiosk, for example, in the retail, we had a lot of media coverage of that. When we've done mental health first aid training, we actually were going to be celebrating the 10,000th person that got trained, and we had a lot of media coming, and unfortunately we had a week of beautiful weather except for the one day that we had that, so we had to cancel that, but we're going to have a lot of media there. So the media has gotten this, and I think, I don't know, and this is just me, okay, so my sense is that they like covering these stories a lot more than some of the more negative stories that you hear about mental health issues. They like coming. We've just had a nice story on the mental health screening that we were doing. We had, for National Depression Screening Day, we had 8 different screening sites all over Philadelphia, train stations. I was in a park, you know. We were, you know, in the community. The media kind of likes that. They like to see folks out there addressing these issues from a more positive standpoint. And so I think they've been pretty good so far. Yes?
Yes? With regard to the online screening, do you have any data,
Well, not so much impact, but one of the things that's been interesting, when we started the online screening, as I mentioned, there was a lot of trepidation by people in my department, and they were like, people aren't going to do this in public. People aren't going to, you know, we're afraid that if people see that they have symptoms consistent with PTSD, that it will, quote, freak them out in some way, and it might precipitate a crisis. We haven't seen any of that. In fact, we've seen the opposite of that. We originally, I think at one point the first year that we did it, we had only a few hundred people that did the online screening. I think this year we'll probably have 15,000 people that do the screening. The numbers are doing this in terms of the people that are accessing the online screening. Here's the best example of the screening. So we partnered with a community organization. They were doing an AIDS benefit, and we partnered with them. We set up screening. Now, this is a concert. This is a concert at an outdoor venue, probably about 6,000 people at this outdoor venue that are coming for this benefit concert. We set up in the back to do mental health screening. We had, I think, the number is probably about 400. We had over 100 people that actually did the screening, and probably about 400 people that sort of came through. No one would have guessed that in the middle of Philadelphia at a concert, people would publicly do mental health screens, but they do, and they would come over and they say, "I got, you know, a brother, or I got, you know, a sister, or, you know, I've been feeling depressed." Almost every time that we do this in the community, there's at least one person who is in crisis that we connect with services right away. So again, it's one of those things where we have lots of anecdotal data that we are making a difference. Certainly we're making a difference in the lives of people who are coming up saying, you know, I'm feeling suicidal, and we're connecting them. And so if we only help that one person, I think it would be worth the effort, particularly when people are suicidal. But we need to go that next step and set up a similar kind of evaluation for that work as we have with Mental Health First Aid. Sure. All kinds of ways. So when we do community presentations, we're doing a lot of marketing. When we're doing a lot of different events in the community, we're actually using, I showed you the mural arts work, but we're actually using art as a strategy to engage communities. We've done spoken word performances. We have an Engaging Men of Color, for example, initiative where we're trying to engage men of color in different ways, because we have, you know, when we talk about penetration, we have lower penetration for African-American men, for example, Asian men, for example. And so what we're doing is we're using those community performances to have a storytelling performance, but the themes are around mental health issues, and then we're opening it up afterwards. And so we're using lots of different strategies, and then driving people to the website. When we do that, we also have, you know, put the signs on buses, you know, those kinds of things. Yes, and I think we have time for one more. And yes.
I just wondered if you peers had a pressure.
Yes, absolutely. Peers are a very big part of the work that we do in Philadelphia. You know, when you saw the 25,000 people at the recovery walk, we've made a very conscious effort to highlight and incorporate people with lived experience in everything that we do. And so with a lot of the mental health first aid training, that is done by people with lived experience. Very, very important part of our strategy. Well, we're going to be here for a second. Actually, they're going to be here for a second. I got a plane to catch, and because I got to do another talk tomorrow. So we really appreciate you coming, first of all, staying to the end, and all of the great questions that you had. So thank you all for being here. And thank you.